including relaxation, Chapter 6, exposure, Chapter 8, and exercise, Chapter 9, to help your amygdala respond in new ways, giving you more control over your life. Chapter 6. Reaping the benefits of relaxation. Both in your daily life, as well as when you are actively engaged in the exposure techniques described in Chapters 7 and 8, we believe you will find relaxation practices extremely valuable in reducing anxiety. When you feel anxious, other people may try to help you feel better by telling you not to worry, that everything will be all right, or that you have no reason to be anxious. You may try the same strategy with yourself. The problem with this approach is that when you try to use thinking processes and logic to cope with feelings of anxiety, you're relying on cortex-based methods. And by itself, the cortex can't reduce the stress response for two primary reasons. First, as we've noted, the cortex doesn't have many direct connections to the amygdala. Second, the initiator of the stress response is the amygdala. Therefore, interventions that target the amygdala are more direct and effective in easing anxiety. By activating the sympathetic nervous system, SNS, and stimulating the release of adrenaline and cortisol, the central nucleus can instantly increase heart rate and blood pressure, direct blood flow to the extremities, and slow digestive processes. Consider Jane, who had to give a speech. She found herself trembling, with her heart pounding and her stomach feeling queasy. These spontaneously activated processes, whether described as anxiety, the stress response, or the fight, flight, or freeze response, result from brain activities that don't lie within conscious awareness. However, lack of conscious awareness doesn't mean we completely lack control over these processes. For example, although we don't consciously control our rate of breathing most of the time, we can deliberately modify it if we choose to do so. A variety of techniques have been developed for activating the parasympathetic nervous system, PNS, which reverses many of the effects the central nucleus creates by activating the SNS. As mentioned in Chapter 1, whereas activation of the SNS creates the fight, flight, or freeze response, the action of the PNS is often referred to as rest and digest. It slows heart rate and increases secretion of gastric juices and insulin, as well as activity of the intestines. The PNS is more likely to be activated when people are relaxed. That's why medical professionals often encourage anxious patients to engage in activities that strengthen the tendency toward PNS activation and decrease SNS activation. Relaxation training is one of the primary methods suggested to facilitate PNS activation. A variety of studies have shown that techniques that promote relaxation, such as breathing exercises and meditation, reduce activation in the amygdala. When you reduce amygdala activation, you reduce SNS responding, and with practice, the PNS can be trained to intervene. Relaxation training. Relaxation training has been formally recognized since the 1930s when physician and psychiatrist Edmund Jacobson developed a process called progressive muscle relaxation. Recent neuroimaging studies have identified actual changes in the brain that occur when people practice various relaxation techniques, including meditation, chanting, and breathing exercises. These studies have found that many of these approaches almost immediately reduce activation in the amygdala, which is good news for people who struggle with anxiety. We present several such techniques in this chapter, and we encourage you to try all of them to discover which ones work best for you or which you prefer. Whichever you choose to practice in the long run, you'll know that scientific evidence indicates that you can directly affect your amygdala when you use them. Most approaches to relaxation focus on two physical processes, breathing and muscle relaxation. Individuals respond in different ways to various relaxation strategies, but virtually everyone will benefit from relaxation training. Relaxation is a very flexible approach that can be used in many situations, and it has many beneficial effects, especially in the short term. The effectiveness of relaxation strategies is often immediately apparent. Relaxation is also an integral component of more complex approaches to reducing stress and anxiety, such as meditation and yoga. Breathing-focused strategies. If you take a few moments right now to attend to your breathing, you may be able to demonstrate to yourself some of the basic effects of relaxation. Take a deep breath, making a point of expanding your lungs as you inhale deeply and slowly. Don't hold your breath. Allow yourself to exhale naturally. Some people feel a reduction in anxiety almost immediately when they do this for several minutes. Merely altering your breathing and adopting a slow rhythm of deep breathing can be soothing and relieve stress. People tend to hold their breath or breathe shallowly when experiencing something stressful without being aware that they are doing so. Several specific breathing techniques can help you consciously deepen your breathing and reduce your heart rate to counter physiological processes that are part of SNS activation. Here are a few that are especially effective. Exercise. Slow, deep breathing. The first technique is basically the same as what we described above. Slow, deep breathing. Practice it now, taking a few deep breaths. Inhale slowly and deeply, and exhale fully. Don't force your breathing. Rather, breathe gently, both in and out. It doesn't matter whether you breathe through your mouth or nose. Just breathe in a comfortable manner. Note how this deliberate slowing and deepening of your breathing affects you. Does it have a calming effect? Not everyone finds slow, deep breathing to be calming. Increased attention to breathing can increase anxiety in some people, especially those with asthma or other breathing difficulties. In such cases, people may get greater benefit from relaxation strategies that focus on reducing muscle tension or that use music or movement. That said, most people are surprised at how effective simple breathing exercises can be in reducing anxiety and increasing calmness almost immediately. Many students find this approach helpful before and during exams. Nervous drivers use it while on the road, and people who are claustrophobic often find it helpful when they're in an enclosed space. Plus, the breath is readily available in all situations. You can practice slow, deep breathing almost any time and anywhere, and it's completely free. Breathing techniques to counter hyperventilation. When people are anxious, they're likely to breathe quickly and shallowly. They may not get enough oxygen, which produces an uncomfortable sensation. Hyperventilation can also result due to expelling carbon dioxide too quickly, resulting in low levels of carbon dioxide in the blood. This can cause dizziness, belching, a feeling of unreality or confusion, or feelings of tingling in the hands, feet, or face. Hyperventilation disrupts the balance between oxygen and carbon dioxide in the body, and the amygdala detects this instantly. Correcting this imbalance using deliberate breathing techniques sends a signal to the amygdala to relax. Consider Tony, who thought her feelings of dizziness and tingling were just a part of her anxiety. When she learned that she was experiencing the results of hyperventilation, she found that she could reduce those symptoms by simply attending to her breath. People who are hyperventilating are often instructed to deliberately slow their breathing or breathe into a paper bag. The bag captures carbon dioxide when they exhale. Therefore, breathing in from the bag increases the amount of carbon dioxide inhaled and replaced in the bloodstream. It's a very effective method of reversing lightheadedness and other anxiety symptoms. Diaphragmatic breathing. A specific method of breathing known as diaphragmatic or abdominal breathing is recommended for its particular effectiveness in activating the PNS. This type of breathing helps turn on a relaxation response in the body. In this technique, you breathe more from the abdomen than from the chest. and the movement of the diaphragm, the muscle under the lungs, has a massaging effect on the liver, the stomach, and even the heart. This type of breathing is thought to have beneficial effects on many internal organs. Exercise. Diaphragmatic breathing. To practice diaphragmatic breathing, sit comfortably and place one hand on your chest and the other on your stomach. Take a deep breath and see which part of your body expands. Effective diaphragmatic breathing will cause your stomach to expand as you inhale and retract as you exhale. Your chest shouldn't move much at all. Try to focus on breathing deeply in a manner that expands your stomach as you fill your lungs with air. Many people tend to pull their stomachs in as they inhale, which keeps the diaphragm from expanding downward effectively. Shifting breathing patterns with regular practice. Healthy breathing techniques can become second nature with practice. Pay attention to your style and pattern of breathing and work to consciously modify it. Practicing for brief 5-minute sessions at least 3 times a day can increase your awareness of your breathing habits and help you train yourself to breathe in more healthful, effective ways. Also, try to notice times when you're holding your breath, breathing shallowly or hyperventilating, and then make a deliberate effort to adopt a better breathing pattern. Breathing is an essential bodily response that you can control, and in the process, you can reduce amygdala activation and its effects. With practice, you'll find that healthy breathing becomes a valuable tool, and that it alleviates many symptoms that you may have thought were part of your anxiety. Muscle-focused relaxation strategies. The second component of most relaxation training programs is muscle relaxation, which also works to counter amygdala-based activation of the SNS. The SNS creates increased muscle tension because fibers in the SNS activate muscles in preparation for responding. Although the problems we face in today's world are seldom things we can fight or run from, this muscle tension is programmed into the nervous system, and people often feel stiff and sore because of it. Luckily, as with breathing, you can modify your muscle tension if you deliberately attend to it. Additionally, relaxing your muscles can promote the PNS responding you want to increase. People are often completely unaware that muscle tension builds up as a result of amygdala-based anxiety. However, if you observe yourself, you may find that you often clench your teeth or tense your stomach muscles for no apparent reason. Certain areas of the body seem to be vulnerable as repositories for muscle tension, including the jaw, forehead, shoulders, back, and neck. Constant muscle tension uses energy and can leave people feeling tight and exhausted at the end of the day. The first step in reducing muscle tension is to discover which areas of your body tend to tighten up when you're anxious. The next exercise will help you do just that. Exercise. Doing a muscle tension inventory. Right now, check your jaw, tongue, and lips to see if they're relaxed or tense. Consider whether muscle tension is tightening your forehead. Determine whether your shoulders are loose, low, and relaxed, or tightened up toward your ears. Some people tense their stomach as though they expect to be punched at any moment. Others clench their fists or curl their toes. Take a brief inventory of your entire body to see where you're holding your tension at this moment. Once you have an idea of which areas in your body are vulnerable to muscle tension, you're ready to learn to relax those areas. To begin, you may find it helpful to experience the difference between feelings of tension and relaxation in your muscles. The next exercise will help you explore that. Exercise. Exploring tension versus relaxation. Tension is often experienced as a tight or strained feeling. In contrast, relaxation is often described as a loose and heavy feeling. To help you tune in to your own experience of tension versus relaxation, make a fist with one of your hands and clench it tightly while counting to 10. Then let that hand relax by dropping it limply into your lap or onto another surface. Compare the feeling of tension that you experienced as you clenched your fist to the feeling of relaxation while the muscles are loose and limp. Do you recognize a difference? Also, compare the hand that you tightened and relaxed to the other hand and notice whether one hand feels more relaxed than the other. Often, tensing and releasing muscles helps create a feeling of relaxation in those muscles. Exercise. Progressive muscle relaxation. One of the most popular muscle relaxation techniques is progressive muscle relaxation, which involves focusing on one muscle group at a time. It's a practice of briefly tensing and then relaxing the muscles in one group, then switching to the next muscle group, and then the next until all major muscle groups are relaxed. When you first learn progressive muscle relaxation, it may take you up to 30 minutes to complete the entire process of tensing and relaxing every muscle group. With time and practice, you can train yourself to relax your muscles more readily, so much less time is required. If you practice diligently, eventually you'll probably be able to achieve a satisfying level of relaxation in less than 5 minutes. We recommend doing this exercise while sitting in a firm chair. If you're driving, please listen to this exercise at another time. Begin by focusing your attention on your breathing. Take a few moments to practice slow, deep, diaphragmatic breathing. Try to slow your breathing to 5 or 6 breaths per minute to help promote relaxation. You may find it helpful to think a word, relax, or peace, as you breathe. Or you might prefer to use imagery to enhance relaxation, perhaps imagining that with each exhalation you're breathing out stress, and with each inhalation you're breathing in clean air. Imagine that the stress has a color, perhaps black or red, and that you're breathing it out and filling yourself with stress-free, colorless air. Next, you'll begin to focus on specific muscle groups. As you do, maintain some attention on your breath and keep it slow and deep. Begin by tensing the muscles in your hands by briefly clenching your hands into fists. Let go and try to completely relax your hands, including each finger. Let your hands drop into your lap and feel gravity pulling them down. You may need to wiggle your fingers to relax them. Next, focus your attention on your forearms and create tension by making fists again, and also tightening your forearm muscles to briefly create muscle tension in your forearms. Now, drop your hands into your lap and allow the muscles in your hands and forearms to completely relax. Focus on releasing any tension in your forearms and feeling the heaviness of relaxation. Next, move to your upper arms, pulling your hands and forearms close to your upper arms and tensing your biceps. Then, completely loosen and relax, allowing your arms to hang at your sides and feeling how the weight of your relaxed hands and arms lengthens your biceps into a relaxed state. Shaking your arms may help release any remaining tension. Now, turn your attention to your feet and tense them by curling your toes. Release the tension by wiggling or stretching your toes. Continue working up through your legs in the same way. Tense your calves by leaving your heels on the ground and flexing your feet and toes upward, Then relax by stretching your feet out comfortably. Tense your thighs by pushing your feet into the ground. Then release and focus on the sensations of relaxation. Now, tense and release your buttocks. Now, move to the muscles in your forehead and tense them by frowning. To relax, lift your eyebrows, then allow them to relax into a comfortable position. Next, turn to your jaw, tongue, and lips, clenching your teeth together firmly, pushing your tongue against your teeth, and pushing your lips together. Now, release the tension in your mouth by allowing it to be slightly open, with your lips and tongue relaxed. This is a good time to check to make sure your breathing is still slow and deep. Now, tense your neck by tipping your head back. To relax, gently tip your head to one side, then the other, then gently tip your chin toward your chest. Next, tense your shoulders by bringing them up toward your ears, then relax completely, allowing the weight of your arms and hands to pull your shoulders down. Finally, move to your torso and tighten the muscles in your abdomen as though bracing for a punch to the stomach. Then relax completely, allowing your stomach muscles to be loose and soft. Take a moment to feel the sense of deep relaxation throughout your entire body. Now gently stretch comfortably and return to normal activities. We recommend that you practice progressive relaxation daily, preferably at least 2 times per day, until you've reduced the time it takes to achieve relaxation to approximately 10 minutes. Typically, people eventually learn to relax most of their muscles without having to tense them first, perhaps tensing only stubborn muscle groups that seem particularly vulnerable to stress-related tension. Different groups of muscles may be problematic for different people. For example, one person may find that he's constantly gritting his teeth, while another holds tension in her shoulders. Learning to relax effectively is an individual process that you must tailor to yourself with your specific needs in mind. Designing your own strategies for muscle relaxation. Try a variety of approaches to muscle relaxation and choose the one that's most effective for you. After all, you know yourself best. As you experiment with different approaches, do bear in mind that with any technique, more practice is often required at first. If you have an injury or chronic pain difficulties, tensing your muscles may be counterproductive. If this is the case for you, you can follow the above procedure for progressive muscle relaxation, but instead of tensing each muscle group first, simply turn your attention to each muscle group in turn, and try to completely relax and loosen all of the muscles in that group. Even if you use the tensing recommended in progressive muscle relaxation, once you master the process of relaxing your muscles, you should feel free to use the tension-free approach, which is more efficient because it's quicker. For the most effective approach to reducing activation of the amygdala and SNS in order to produce a PNS response, combine breathing-focused methods with muscle relaxation. Imagery. Using imagery or visualization is also a beneficial relaxation strategy. Some people have the ability to imagine themselves in another location and can use visualization to effectively attain a relaxed state. If you're one of those individuals, you may find that imagining yourself on a beach or in a peaceful forest glade allows you to achieve a more satisfying state of relaxation than a focus on muscle relaxation does. Either way, the most important goal is to achieve deep breathing and relaxed muscles. That's the key to reducing activation of the amygdala. The truth is, it doesn't matter whether you attain this state by directly focusing on your breathing and muscles or by imagining yourself in a setting that allows you to relax. Exercise. Assessing your ability to use imagery. Listen to this description of a relaxing situation. Then take a few moments to close your eyes and imagine yourself in that setting. Imagine yourself on a warm beach. Feel the sun warming your skin and the cool breeze coming off the water. Listen to the sounds of the waves as they wash against the shore and the calls of birds in the distance. Allow yourself to relax and enjoy the beach for several minutes. How well were you able to imagine yourself in the described setting? If the visualization arose for you readily and you find it pleasant and engaging, we highly recommend that you use imagery as one of your relaxation strategies. It may allow you to achieve a relaxed state more effectively than other approaches. On the other hand, if you found it difficult to relax using this method and noticed your mind wandering, you'll probably find other strategies more helpful. Exercise. Practicing imagery-based relaxation. When you use imagery to relax, you take yourself to another location in your imagination. Start by slowing your breathing and relaxing your body as you mentally travel to another scene. What follows is a guided meditation based on the image of a beach to give you an overview of the process. The key is to close your eyes and allow yourself to experience this special place in detail. Try to use all of your senses, sight, sound, smell, touch, and even taste, as you imagine yourself in this particularly relaxing situation. If you're driving, please listen to this exercise at another time. Imagine yourself walking on a sandy path to a beach. As you walk on the path, you're surrounded by trees that keep you in dark shade. You feel the sand begin to get into your shoes as you walk along. You can hear the leaves in the trees softly moving in the wind, but up ahead you hear another sound, gentle waves washing up on the shore. As you continue, you leave the shade of the trees to walk out onto a sunny, sandy beach. The sun warms your head and shoulders as you stand still for a moment to take in your surroundings. The sky is a beautiful shade of blue, and wispy white clouds seem to hang motionless in the sky. You take off your shoes and feel the warm sand as your feet sink in. Holding your shoes, you move toward the water. The sound of the waves rhythmically washing up on the shore has a hypnotic quality. You breathe deeply, in unison with the waves. The water is dark blue, and far off, on the horizon, you can see a darker blue line where the water meets the light blue sky. In the distance, you see two sailboats, one with a white sail and one with a red sail. They appear to be racing one another. The damp smell of driftwood reaches your nose, and you see some driftwood nearby. You place your shoes on a smooth, weathered log and walk toward the waves. Seagulls swoop overhead, and you hear their excited cries as they glide on the gentle breeze coming in with the waves. You feel the breeze on your skin and smell its freshness. As you walk toward the waves, you see the sun reflected on the water. You walk into the damp sand, leaving footprints now as you walk along the shore. A wave breaks over your feet, surprisingly cold at first. You stand still as the waves wash over your ankles. Listening to the repetitive sounds of the waves and the cries of the gulls, you feel the wind blowing your hair away from your face. You take slow, deep breaths of the cool, clean air. We recommend that you end each imagery session gradually, counting backward slowly from 10 to 1. With each number, gradually become more aware of your surroundings, the actual environment around you. When you reach 1, open your eyes and return to the present moment, feeling refreshed and relaxed. Through imagery, you can take a trip each day that's limited only by your imagination, and that can decrease SNS activation in just a few minutes. Choose locations that you can explore and that lead to feelings of peace and comfort. As you practice, remember that visualization will be most effective at reducing amygdala activation if you achieve relaxation in your muscles and slow and deepen your breathing. Meditation. Various meditative practices, including mindfulness, which is currently the most popular approach, have been shown to reduce amygdala activation. All forms of meditation involve focusing attention, perhaps on the breath, or perhaps on a specific object or thought. Extensive research on meditative practices has shown that they affect a variety of processes in both the cortex and the amygdala. Because it's a relaxation strategy that can target the cortex, we'll provide a more detailed explanation of meditation and mindfulness in particular in Chapter 11, How to Calm Your Cortex. However, meditation is also an effective method for calming amygdala activation, particularly when the focus of attention is the breath. If you're experienced in meditation or interested in it, we encourage you to pursue this practice. Research has demonstrated that a regular practice of meditation can reduce a variety of stress-related difficulties, including high blood pressure, anxiety, panic, and insomnia. But most importantly, for people who struggle with anxiety, meditation has also been shown to have direct and immediate calming effects on the amygdala. It produces both short-term and long-term effects in the amygdala, reducing amygdala activation in a variety of situations and increasing PNS activation. Clearly, it's an effective relaxation strategy, and we've spoken to many people who find that incorporating regular meditation into their morning routine decreases their overall anxiety and helps them feel more prepared to cope with the demands of the day. Breath-focused meditation. Many approaches to meditation include a focus on the breath, with meditators concentrating on the experience of breathing or modifying the breath in some way. Studies have shown these breath-focused practices to be effective in reducing the amygdala's reactivity. In one study, people with social anxiety were trained in either breath-focused meditation or distraction techniques. Then they were presented with negative self-beliefs related to their anxiety, such as, "People always judge me." Those who had engaged in breath-focused meditation had less amygdala activation in response to the statements. In another study, those who had engaged in breath-focused meditation had less amygdala activation in response to the statements. In another study, adults without an anxiety disorder were trained in breath-focused or compassion-focused meditation. All experienced a general and lasting decrease in amygdala activation, with those who were trained in breath-focused meditation experiencing greater benefits. Using meditation effectively requires some practice. In most studies, people received at least 16 hours of training prior to being assessed as to whether practicing meditation had changed their amygdala functioning. So, for maximum benefit, you may wish to seek specific training from a therapist or other instructor. Mindfulness approaches to meditation are particularly popular at this time, and books on mindfulness techniques are plentiful. There's also a good chance that you can find a therapist or other mindfulness meditation instructor in your area. Meditation techniques that focus on breathing and relaxation seem to be the most effective in modifying the amygdala's response. One study found that after meditation, people have a slower breathing rate and increased PNS activation. These effects are probably central to its effectiveness. The next exercise will help you enjoy the benefits of reducing activation of the amygdala through a focus on breathing. Exercise. Breathing meditation. This practice is very straightforward. Close your eyes if you like and simply focus your attention on your breath. Breathe in through your nose, and as you do so, attend to the way the air feels as it travels through your nostrils. Don't force the breath. Simply take in long, slow breaths and observe the sensations of inhaling and exhaling in your nose and chest. Enjoy the sensations of breathing. Notice the difference between the air moving into your nostrils and the air coming out. Pay attention to the way the air causes your lungs to expand. Notice the different stages of breath. As you inhale and air fills your lungs, and as you exhale and your lungs empty. Then focus only on the process of inhalation, noting that the beginning of an inhalation feels different than the process of inhalation or the end of an inhalation. Notice the same aspects of exhaling, the beginning, the middle, and the end. During this meditation, your mind is likely to wander to other thoughts. This is common and natural. When this happens, just bring your focus back to your breath. If it wanders 50 times, bring it back to your breath 50 times. Continue focusing on your breath for about 5 minutes, then slowly and gently come out of the meditation. Relaxation as a daily process. Whatever approach you choose, working opportunities for relaxation into your daily schedule is an essential part of coping with fear and anxiety. Consider practicing in the morning or evening, during work breaks, or even on public transportation or while walking. Try to schedule at least 3 or 4 opportunities for some type of relaxation each day. Even a 5-minute relaxation session can reduce your heart rate and muscle tension. If you're prone to panic attacks, relaxation strategies can help prevent them or provide relief. In addition, regular practice can help reduce your overall stress level. Like most people who struggle with anxiety, you may find that tension tends to build gradually over the course of your day. You can thank your central nucleus and SNS for keeping your body in this tense, alert state. As your central nucleus activates your SNS during the day, you can keep switching your SNS off by using relaxation to activate your PNS. Just like an air conditioner that keeps cooling a home, you need to keep cooling off your amygdala. The advantage of the techniques in this chapter is that, unlike air conditioning or medication or psychotherapy, they cost nothing beyond a small amount of time. If you practice relaxation techniques routinely, eventually they will become second nature and help decrease your general anxiety level. We've outlined a number of different approaches to relaxation that can be helpful in reducing activation of the amygdala. There's no single right way to achieve the relaxation that reduces amygdala-based anxiety. You simply need to find which techniques work best for you. Of course, the ability to relax is only beneficial if you use it when you need it, so be sure to choose strategies you can incorporate into your daily life. If you're only able to achieve muscle relaxation while lying down, or can only use imagery when your surroundings are perfectly silent, you won't be able to use those techniques in all situations. This may mean that you sometimes need to use different techniques, or it may just mean you need more practice. Summary. Sometimes you may try to reason yourself into calming down using cortex-based strategies in an attempt to think yourself into relaxing. We hope this chapter has helped you see the usefulness of another approach. Instead of focusing on your thoughts, the cortex approach, you can work directly on the physiological responses that the central nucleus of the amygdala is initiating and counter them with PNS activation. The ultimate goal is to increase activation of your PNS to help you recover from the stress response and promote well-being. Slower breathing and relaxed muscles will send a message directly to the amygdala that the body is calming down, which is more likely to calm the amygdala than all of the thinking you can do. Chapter 7. Understanding Triggers. In this chapter, we turn our attention from the central nucleus of the amygdala, which initiates the stress response, to the lateral nucleus of the amygdala, which receives information from the senses and forms emotional memories. The lateral nucleus is the decision-making portion of the amygdala, which determines whether the central nucleus should react to a particular sight or sound. It does this by scanning the sensory information it's receiving and, based on emotional memories, determining whether a threat exists. The lateral nucleus also creates anxiety-related memories, and changing those memories is essential in rewiring the amygdala. In order to communicate with the lateral nucleus and influence the memories it creates, you need to have a clear understanding of the language of the amygdala. Using the language of the amygdala. In Chapter 2, you learned that the language of the amygdala is based on associations. Specifically, the lateral nucleus recognizes associations between events occurring in close proximity in time. We learn to fear triggers that are associated with negative events, whether or not a trigger actually causes a negative experience. When a trigger is paired with a negative event, the amygdala is programmed to produce anxiety. Consider Lynn, who experienced a sexual assault. She developed a strong panic reaction to the smell of the cologne her assailant had worn, even though the cologne itself wasn't relevant to the attack. In the language of the amygdala, the pairing of a trigger with a negative event is very powerful. Thinking processes from the cortex, like logic and reasoning, are of little use when dealing with fear and anxiety in the amygdala. Trying to reason yourself out of anxiety isn't very effective because you aren't speaking the language of the amygdala. You need to learn to focus on pairings, and this chapter will help you learn how to do that. Working with amygdala-based emotional memories can be difficult, as these memories may be formed and recalled by the amygdala outside of your awareness. Therefore, many of their influences occur without your conscious knowledge. A variety of sensory experiences, even seemingly irrelevant cues that you may barely notice in a situation, like a sound or a smell, can create anxiety. For this reason, it may take some work to learn to recognize triggers, because you may not be consciously aware of them. Understanding triggers. A trigger is an anxiety-provoking stimulus, such as a sensation, object, or event that was originally neutral, meaning it wouldn't cause fear or anxiety for most people. Originally, it wasn't associated with any emotional memories, positive or negative, and therefore didn't cause any reaction. In Chapter 2, we discussed Don, a Vietnam War veteran whose PTSD is set off by the smell of a particular soap. For Don, the soap was associated with negative events, so he had a negative reaction to it. For Don's wife, however, the soap was neutral because her amygdala hadn't created any emotional memories about it. Therefore, the soap doesn't trigger any reaction in her. Most sensations, objects, and events aren't typically associated with positive or negative emotions in most people. A crowd is just a crowd, an elevator is just an elevator, and so on. These things become triggers when an emotional memory is made, whether with anxiety, happiness, or even affection. The reason a stimulus that's been paired with a negative event is called a trigger is because, due to association, it will cause or trigger a fearful reaction. This change is due to memories the lateral nucleus makes when the trigger is paired with a negative event. For example, in Lynn's case, the smell of a specific cologne didn't originally cause her to experience any fear or anxiety. It was just a neutral smell. But when Lynn was assaulted, her amygdala created an emotional memory about the cologne her assailant was wearing. A formerly neutral trigger has been paired with an emotion-arousing negative event, meaning an event that results in discomfort, distress, or pain. A negative event leads to an emotional reaction. Lynn's experience of being sexually assaulted is obviously a negative event. The two events are paired together, with a negative event following the trigger in time. Lynn smelled the cologne just before the sexual assault occurred, and that created a pairing. These kinds of pairings are very important to the amygdala. The pairing between the trigger and the negative event changes the reaction caused by the trigger. Instead of eliciting no emotional reaction, the trigger now leads to a learned fear reaction. So in Lynn's case, because the cologne was paired with the sexual assault, the cologne now causes Lynn's amygdala to produce a fear reaction. Before, the cologne was neutral. Now it's a trigger that will cause fear. This fear reaction was learned in the lateral amygdala and stored as an emotional memory. We'll use another example to demonstrate how this works. Normally, the sound of a car horn doesn't cause a strong panic reaction. For a person to learn to respond in this way to a horn, it must be paired with something very negative, like an accident. In this example, the pairing of the sound of a horn with an automobile accident causes the lateral amygdala to form a memory about car horns. Afterward, whenever the amygdala hears a car horn, it produces a fear reaction. It's important to bear in mind that the horn didn't cause the accident, it's just associated with the accident. Remember, the language of the amygdala is based on associations or pairings, not cause and effect. Triggers can come in many forms. They may be sights, smells, sounds, or situations. For example, after a person is in an auto accident, the sight of a specific intersection, the smell of burned rubber, the sound of brakes, or even the sensation of braking can all cause the person to feel fear. In fact, after a single traumatic experience, a number of different triggers, intersection, burned rubber smell, the sound of brakes, or a car horn, and the sensation of braking, can each cause fear. Each trigger becomes a cue for fear or anxiety. The fear response is a learned response, and what's learned can be changed. Learning to identify triggers and the negative events they're associated with is very helpful in understanding the language of the amygdala and its role in producing your anxiety. Here are some helpful guidelines. Both the trigger and the negative event are stimuli, meaning they're objects, events, or situations that you see, hear, feel, smell, or experience. The trigger differs from the negative event because you learn to fear or be anxious about the trigger, whereas the negative event is something you don't have to learn to react to. The trigger activates emotions in you, even though you may know those emotions aren't logical, and even though you may want to stop responding to the trigger in that way. Learned fear responses can occur with a variety of objects, sounds, or situations, as long as they're associated in time with a strong negative event. Feeling motion sickness on a roller coaster can cause someone to be fearful of amusement park rides. On the other hand, a different person might feel excited on the same ride and love the roller coaster as a result. The lateral nucleus of the amygdala recognizes and remembers these associations, and that's what determines our subsequent reactions. These emotional memories can be very strong and enduring. Your amygdala knows. The most powerful tool in coping with anxiety reactions is having an in-depth understanding of your own unique anxiety responses. To be effective in retraining your brain to resist anxiety reactions, specific knowledge about your own triggers is essential. For this reason, it's crucial that you take a close look at situations and events that are connected with your anxiety responses. This will help you identify the triggers that you need to address through exposure therapy, a powerful technique we'll explain in the next chapter. People aren't always aware of the exact triggers that have come to elicit their fear. And as you now know, triggers aren't necessarily logical. Nevertheless, the amygdala is very responsive to them. In order to effectively reduce your anxiety reactions, you need to identify the triggers that provoke your anxiety and then use the approach in Chapter 8 to change your amygdala's response to them. Exercise: Identifying your triggers. Take a moment to consider the types of situations in which you experience anxiety. If you're thorough, you may come up with a large number of situations. Don't be discouraged. Instead, consider the big picture. Even though you may think the process of examining so many situations will be overwhelming, you'll probably discover that a lesser number of common triggers lie hidden within this wide variety of situations. For example, you may identify a large number of situations at work that trigger your anxiety, but discover a common factor among them when you look more closely, since the same trigger may occur in different situations. Perhaps it's the presence of your boss, the sound of people raising their voices, or situations in which you need to speak before a group. To best identify your triggers, including those that are common to a number of situations, try to consider as many situations as possible in which you feel troublesome anxiety. When you identify situations in which you experience anxiety, don't forget to consider internal sensations that you may be reacting to. For example, if a pounding heart, dizziness, or the feeling of having to use the bathroom causes you to feel panicky, include those in your list, since the internal sensations can also be triggers for anxiety. You can create a worksheet called Anxiety-Provoking Situations using a blank sheet of paper and four columns. On the left, situation that causes anxiety, then level of anxiety, then frequency, and finally triggers in the situation on the right. For level of anxiety, rate the intensity using a scale of 1 to 100, where 1 is minimal and 100 is intolerable. Here's an example to give you an idea of how to use the worksheet. When Manuel used it, the things he listed for situation that causes anxiety were his annual review with his boss, presentations during staff meetings, and arguments with his wife. For the first item, his annual review, he rated his anxiety level at 70 in the second column, and in the third column reported it happens once a year. In the right-hand column, he identified a number of triggers: the review form he must complete, email reminders from his boss about scheduling the meeting, being in his boss's office, talking to his boss about his performance, the frown he often sees on his boss's face, and the tone of voice that his boss uses when irritated. In the next row, he listed staff meeting presentations in the first column. He rated the intensity of these at 95, indicating that they are almost unbearable, and noted that he has to present them about once a month. For triggers, he identified the meeting room and the dry mouth he gets when talking, as well as his coworkers looking at him, their criticisms of his ideas, and the facial expressions they make. Then, as Manuel began to write arguments with my wife in the third row, he recognized a pattern in the triggers in these situations. He saw that having to present himself and his ideas in the face of others' criticisms was the source of a lot of his anxiety, and that negative facial expressions are a repeating trigger. Using the worksheet to identify specific triggers that elicit anxiety for you is very important. Consider the sounds you hear, what you see, the sensations you feel, and what you smell or taste. Also, consider what you think or imagine. Bear in mind that the amygdala doesn't always process sensations in the detailed way that you're capable of experiencing them, so a general description of triggers is sufficient. After creating the list, note whether specific triggers appear repeatedly or whether you see a pattern across the different situations that provoke anxiety. This will help you identify your own personal triggers for anxiety. Sometimes the reason a specific trigger provokes anxiety is obvious. For example, the sight of an elevator would clearly create anxiety in someone with claustrophobia. At other times, the reason for the connection between the trigger and anxiety is less clear. As with Don, the Vietnam veteran who finally figured out that the smell of a certain brand of soap was a trigger. His amygdala clearly recognized an association between the smell of the soap and the danger of combat. While this isn't necessarily a logical association, you can see how it arose. In some cases, the reason a specific trigger elicits anxiety may remain unclear. Fortunately, it isn't necessary to know exactly how the trigger came to cause fearful responding. Regardless of the reason, you can retrain your amygdala, even when you don't know what created the emotional memory. As you are creating your worksheet and identifying your own specific triggers for anxiety, you may experience noticeable levels of anxiety due to simply thinking about triggers. As mentioned, the amygdala reacts to triggers in a rather general way. Once the sound of a certain dog growling elicits fear, the sound of other dogs growling is also likely to elicit fear due to generalization. This means that even a sound that's similar to a dog growling may result in a feeling of fear. Perhaps most surprising is that simply imagining the sound of a dog growling can be enough to activate the amygdala. This is because when you imagine a sound, you're activating the memory of the sound, and that memory can set off a reaction in the amygdala. If you feel anxiety as you review the situations you've listed, don't worry about it. Instead, use your emotional responses as an indicator. These emotional responses can help you identify which triggers produce anxiety, allowing you to learn what sets off your amygdala. If you experience some distress, don't be discouraged. In fact, thinking about fear-eliciting triggers is the first step in activating new neural connections and beginning to rewire your brain. So if you begin to feel anxious, tell yourself that you're just heating up the circuits that you need to modify. Take a deep breath and stick with it. Of course, that may be easier said than done. This work, by definition, is anxiety-provoking. You may find the process of thinking about triggers overwhelming. If so, you might wish to undertake this exploration with a therapist who can support and guide you through the process. Cognitive behavioral therapists are most experienced with this approach, including exposure therapy, which we explain in Chapter 8. Where to begin? In the next chapter, we'll guide you through the process of retraining your amygdala's reactions to specific triggers. Here, we want to emphasize that ridding yourself of all of your fears is neither possible nor necessary. In fact, it wouldn't be a good idea to eliminate all fears. Fear is appropriate in many situations, such as when you're crossing a busy highway or playing golf as a lightning storm begins. And as mentioned earlier, many fears don't present much of a problem. For example, a fear of flying may have little effect on people who can easily avoid air travel with little consequence. The goal is to begin to modify anxiety reactions that interfere with your ability to live your life in the way you wish. There are three considerations in regard to prioritizing which situations and triggers to work on: the extent to which they interfere with your goals in life, the amount of distress they cause, and the frequency with which they occur. Of course, this isn't an either-or situation. You can choose your focus based on any or all of these factors, but considering them does help you prioritize what to work on first. Triggers that interfere with your goals in life. At the end of the introduction, we asked you to consider what your life would be like if your anxiety weren't a limiting factor. Revisiting your thoughts about your goals and hopes is an important step in deciding which triggers to focus on. We highly recommend prioritizing the situations you'll work on by starting with those that most frequently or severely limit your ability to accomplish your daily goals. Which triggers, along with the accompanying emotional responses, are interfering the most severely or frequently and preventing you from living the life you want to live? Consider Jasmine, who avoided any situation involving public speaking until she enrolled in a nursing program that required her to take a course in public speaking. She quickly saw that her anxiety about public speaking would stand in the way of her goal. This motivated her to seek assistance in reducing her fear of public speaking, and she was soon successful in changing a fear that she'd lived with for years. We encourage you to focus on reducing anxiety in situations where it's an obstacle to achieving your goals. Our intention is to make your goals, not your anxiety, the driving force in your life. Triggers that cause extreme distress. A second consideration in prioritizing situations and triggers to work on is the level of anxiety you feel in different situations. This is why we ask you to rate intensity in the anxiety-provoking situations worksheet. If certain situations produce very high levels of anxiety, you may want to focus on them, since they create intense and possibly debilitating stress. Changing how you feel in these